views and comments expressed on The Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on The Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because they are hard.
Start 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's The Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of The Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to our Friday morning California time space show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in. Up front, I want to let you know that we're doing the 60-minute, one-hour format today. So if you want to get a comment or question in for our guest, Marcia Smith, don't wait until the last minute of the program. You have an hour to do that, and we look forward to hearing from you either by email or our toll-free line or both. Real quickly on important announcements, the toll-free line today is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners, so just hold on. We'll bring you up on air as soon as we can possibly do so. You can also use email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. That's also our website, thespaceshow.com. So do check it out. We have a detailed newsletter there. All of our programs are archived there as well as on our blog. There's a store in the upper left-hand corner. And, of course, the important button, Support the Space Show. Remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with One Giant Leap Foundation. And we're able to bring you these programs because many of you do support us. We thank you very much for that support. We're getting ready to start our annual end-of-the-year campaign. And, again, it is your support that keeps us going. I want to just run through our announcements real quickly since this is a 60-minute show. But do remember that we're trademarked and copyright, and all of you have permission to download our shows and share them and pass them around to people who you think should be interested or are interested in space. And we put very few restrictions on you, but the few are don't do anything commercial with the show. No written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. And please don't edit the programs, even if they're for your own personal website or you have a YouTube channel or something like that. And we appreciate your paying attention to those guidelines. And then we do podcasts through gigadial.net, and you can find the RSS URL on our website and both of our newsletters. We're in iTunes, Microsoft, Zoom, and a host of other places on the net. And then the last thing I want to remind everybody is that we are partially brought to you by the Secure World Foundation. Secure World promotes cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, please visit their own website, www.swfound.org. They also are the sponsors of our webinar series. And just to let you all know, our SLS debate webinar went live on archives in all formats late last night. So you can now pick it up if you want the podcast version, which is audio only, or the audio only as you would any space show program. And the video is now archived on our Vimeo Space Show channel. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And our guest today is Marcia Smith, and Marcia is president of Space and Technology Policy Group, LLC, in Arlington, Virginia, and she specializes in policy analysis of civil, military, and commercial space programs, as well as other technology areas. She's also the founder and editor of the website spacepolicyonline.com. From March of 2006 to March of 2009, she was the director of the Space Studies Board at the NRC, the National Research Council. And from January of 2007 to March 2009, she was also the director of the NRC's Aeronautics and Space Engineering Board. Her bio is on the website in many, many places and easy to find, and it's in this week's newsletter. And rather than spend 10 minutes telling you all about what's written down that makes Marcia so very, very special, I would rather talk to her, and you'll find out yourself why she is so special. Welcome back, Marcia. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Thanks so much for having me, David.
I would like to start out because we have listeners. A lot of them are coming on board outside the United States in Sweden, Trinidad, Taiwan, Venezuela, and other places. Can you do the Civics 101 light on how American political system works, how funding goes to NASA, so they might have a better chance of understanding our discussion today?
Yes, and this is a very quick overview of how the U.S. government works, and hopefully the American listeners know this, but sometimes civics classes have been so long ago that people have forgotten. But fundamentally, the U.S. government has three separate branches: the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. And our system is based on checks and balances, where all three of those branches of government have some oversight of what the other ones are doing, but they also operate very independently. And in terms of laws, Congress is the only one of those that can make laws, but the president has to sign them, and the judiciary can determine that they are not constitutional, so they can overturn all or part of a law. So in terms of the laws under which the U.S. government operates, including the space program, all three branches are involved. But for most people who follow the space program, they're following probably just the executive branch, which is the White House and NASA, DOD, all those other agencies that you're familiar with. That's all in the executive branch. And then in Congress, there's the House and the Senate, and their supporting bodies like the Government Accounting Office and the Congressional Budget Office and entities like that. So mostly people are concerned about the executive branch and the legislative branch. And in terms of funding, under the Constitution, Congress has the power of the purse. Congress is the one that decides how money is spent. So the president comes up with a proposal every year that he sends up to Congress saying, I want to spend this much money on NASA or on any of the other agencies. But it is up to Congress to decide whether or not they want to use the money the way the president proposed. And that often serves as the basis of many of the space policy debates that go on in Washington.
The difference between what Congress wants to do and what the president proposes.
Right. So up in Congress, there are two chambers, the House and the Senate. And a political party controls each of those. Who controls it depends on who got the most votes in the most recent election. Today, the House is controlled by Republicans and the Senate by Democrats. But based on the most recent election, the Republicans will now also have control of the Senate. So there will be a split government where the Republicans control Congress and the Democrats control the White House, which will set up probably even more discord than there has been over the past several years. But in terms of space, civil space, the kind of space that NASA does, in Congress, there generally is bipartisan support for NASA. The biggest issues for NASA usually boil down to how much money there is. And there are dramatic splits between Democrats and Republicans in Congress on how, for example, to deal with the federal deficit, how to reduce government spending, which is one of the clarion calls for the Republican Party. And what they put into effect a couple of years ago, because nobody could agree on how to cut the deficit, they created something called the sequester, where they did these across-the-board cuts. So all the agencies got the same level of cut. So an agency like NASA, which in terms of government spending is relatively small, when you have a percentage cut that goes against NASA, it really does dramatically impact what they can do. It impacts all the agencies. If you have a cut to DOD, which is, you know, $500-600 billion, it's still a major hit to them. But when you do it for an agency like NASA that's maybe $17-18 billion, it really does impact what they do. And so this was because of a disagreement between Republicans and Democrats. They decided to put that on hold for 2 years, for fiscal year 14 and fiscal year 15, which has allowed some more flexibility on how money is being spent. But under law, the sequester will come back into effect for fiscal 16. And right now we're in fiscal 15, and they still haven't decided on the appropriations. But if they can get it done, things are looking pretty good for NASA, the way all the draft bills are written right now. But that doesn't mean very much, because if in fiscal 16 the sequester goes back into effect, then NASA is once again going to be having a very tough time.
Now, the House is the only one that can propose funding bills, right? Spending bills.
No. Under the Constitution, the House originates revenue bills. Like, the House Ways and Means Committee has to originate revenue bills. Either side can originate an appropriations bill, but by tradition, the House starts them off. But it does take agreement between the House and the Senate, and then, of course, the President has to sign it in order to make an appropriations bill become law. And that's another distinction your listeners may be interested in, is that there are bills that provide money, which are called appropriations bills, and then there are bills that provide policy, which are called authorization bills. And the authorization process is separate from the appropriations process. The one that really has to happen in order for any government agency, including NASA, to have money to spend is the appropriations process.
And that can start from either House then, correct?
It can, but by tradition it's the House that starts the bill. And the House has, in fact, passed an appropriations bill for fiscal 15 that includes NASA. The Senate hasn't passed it yet. The Senate has their own version that came out of committee, but it hasn't gone to the Senate floor yet.
Now you have a new Congress that gets sworn in early January. Bills that were passed by one House or the other but not acted upon or done anything with, do they die or can they still be brought up? What happens?
All bills die at the end of a Congress. That doesn't mean the first day of the new Congress they can't reintroduce the same bill, but any bill that is still pending at the end of a Congress dies.
And a Congress is 2 years?
Yes. And so the 113th Congress will end. Hopefully they're going to get out of here in December. Officially, the new Congress, the 114th Congress, begins on January 3rd, so they have up until January 2nd if they need it to pass things. That doesn't happen very often, but it has happened at least once, where the Congress remains in session through the New Year's.
Okay, so both the Senate and the House each have authorization and appropriation committees.
They do. So the appropriations committees are called appropriations. For the authorizations on the House side, it's the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee. And on the Senate side, it's the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee. And NASA had an authorization bill that covered 3 years. And when people talk about how long the bill lasts, that usually refers to how many years of funding was recommended, because authorization bills recommend funding levels. They don't actually give an agency any money. That's only through appropriations, but they recommend a level of funding. And so that last NASA authorization bill recommended funding up through the end of fiscal 13, which has expired. But the policy provisions in the bill remain law regardless of when those funding recommendations run out. So the 2010 NASA Authorization Act, the policy provisions of that are still in force and will remain in force. The House passed a new NASA authorization bill, but it didn't get through the Senate, and people are thinking that it probably will not get through this Congress, and they'll try again next Congress.
So all of this work that they have done, they start over again basically January 3rd.
Yes. Now, in many cases, you have many of the same people still in power, and so they're not starting from scratch, and they can just reintroduce a bill that was pending before the previous Congress. But from a strict standpoint, all the legislation that has not passed dies.
Lots of Space Show listeners think that when you have a new administration, and so now I'm thinking presidential administrations, that would be like the 2016 election, that they come in with a space enthusiast president and the NASA budget's going to go way up and we're going to have programs that take us to the moon and Mars and all sorts of things. Do we have any history to look at where when we change presidents, NASA or space just flourish beyond our wildest expectations?
Well, you know, presidents come in with their own agendas, and the biggest impact on NASA is the budget. And so presidents have to be realistic about how much money can go to NASA versus all of the other agencies. When President Obama came into office, when he was campaigning, things were looking not too bad, but then, of course, a month before the elections was when the economy collapsed. So he was viewed as a presidential candidate who was very pro-NASA, and people in the White House say that he is still pro-NASA. When he came out with his first, you know, sort of revision of what NASA was doing, and he canceled the Constellation program, that still he was envisioning adding money to the NASA budget. He just had different ideas on how to spend it. But even then, as the economy did not improve, he had to scale back his own expectations of how much money was going to go into NASA. So it's not that everything that happens in space is budgetary, but a lot of what happens in space is budgetary. And NASA is just one federal agency that fits into the whole federal budget. And when the will of the people, expressed through their elected representatives, is to cut the deficit and to cut government spending, NASA is not exempted from that. At least it hasn't been.
Now, one more thing before we start talking about current stuff. Explain the CR process, because we hear we're always on CR with our budget, and we're hearing that maybe the Republicans will only approve a short-term expenditure to keep the government only and open, and then, you know, when they're all sworn in January, they'll look at longer-term funding issues. So do they have a choice on how long to fund the government for? Do they just simply don't have a fiscal year budget, correct?
So, again, under the Constitution, Congress has the power of the purse. They fund the government, generally speaking, on an annual basis. This is for what are called discretionary programs like NASA. It's not the same for the mandatory programs like Social Security and Medicare and those kinds of social programs, but for that's called the mandatory part of the budget. The discretionary part of the budget, which is DOD, NASA, State Department, just, you know, everybody else, that part of discretionary spending is done on an annual basis. The fiscal year begins on October 1st of each year and ends on September 30th. So when Congress passes an appropriations bill, it's for that period of time. They're supposed to pass a new appropriations bill before September 30th because the new fiscal year begins on October 1st. That rarely happens. And what they do is they pass something called a continuing resolution, which just keeps everybody funded at their previous year's level until they can finish the regular appropriations bills. And that's where we are right now. They passed a continuing resolution that expires on December 11th. And the plan was that once the elections were over, they'd come back and they would pass the regular appropriations bills that would fund the government through the rest of the fiscal year to September 30th. But politics being what they are, now there are some people who are very upset with President Obama because of his speech last night, and they want to exert more control over the appropriations process. And so some of them want to pass a bill that will still keep the government operating, but maybe just for a few weeks until after January when the new Congress convenes and the Republicans are in control of both houses. So that's a possibility. And when you have a continuing resolution, A, you're held at your previous year's levels. You can't start new programs. You also can't terminate old programs. You're basically stuck in limbo. And it is a problem for any agency, but you know it's a problem for NASA, for example. The president's budget proposed terminating a program called SOFIA, which is an aircraft that has an infrared observatory on it.
Right. We've done a lot of programming on SOFIA.
Okay. And so the president proposed canceling it because they didn't have enough money for it. Congress did not like that. And Congress made it clear in the bill that passed the House and it got through the Senate committee that NASA was not to cancel SOFIA. And they put money in for it, but those bills have not passed. If NASA is held to its fiscal 14 funding level, then somehow it's going to have to figure out what to do about SOFIA. Continue funding it because they know that that's what Congress wants in the long term, but they don't have the money in the short term. It's very difficult. That's just one example of the complications that all agencies, including NASA, and especially research and development agencies like NASA that have programs that are extended over many years, face when you're under a CR.
What is the amount they need to keep SOFIA going? Do you remember?
It was about $80 million. That's the number that sticks in my mind.
Now, if the president doesn't like the budget, he can veto it, correct?
He can, but if they, what they've been doing in recent years is they collect all, there are 12 regular appropriations bills that do all the discretionary spending, and because it's so difficult for them to pass them one by one, they collect them all together into something called an omnibus. So it's one bill that funds the whole government, and so the president only has one chance to veto it, and if he vetoes it because of one provision that he doesn't like, then he's vetoing it for the whole government. And Congress knows that, and so sometimes they'll put things in the bill that they want that they know the president doesn't want because they know that he can't veto it because he needs to keep the government operating.
Have you ever thought of teaching civics at high school level? Or substituting?
Well, it's a fascinating field for those of us who live and breathe Congress and the White House day by day, but I'm not sure it's so fascinating to people elsewhere in the country.
So you're in the Beltway, so I'm assuming it's far more intense and part of daily life there than it is out here in the far west hinterlands.
It is. I have lived and worked inside the Beltway for about 40 years, and I do recognize that gives me a different perspective. It's just different. It's not a bad perspective or a wrong perspective. It's just a different perspective.
So you've weathered the storms, the fights, the disagreements, the different parties. Are we doing anything different today than we were 40 years ago?
Oh, yes. I think that Washington is much more polarized these days. And it's not just between Republicans and Democrats, but even within those parties, there are factions, and there have always been factions. But I think that they're much more politicized today. So I think that there is much more gridlock today than there was. You know, back in the 70s and 80s, sometimes it seemed really bad, and then it got to be the 90s, and then it was the 2000s, and boy, it seems to be getting worse and worse.
Is NASA muddling through more or less the same, or is it running the same way the rest of the government runs?
Well, I think that NASA has been affected by the politicization of Washington and the gridlock, just like all the other agencies are. And it has made it much more complicated to fund programs that take many years to accomplish. So, yes, I do think NASA has been affected by the way Washington operates or doesn't operate, as the case may be.
So a lot of people come on the space show and they say we need to change this annual funding to be able to handle long-term projects, because most space projects are long-term. So they talk about funding in place for 5, 7, 10 years. Does that require a constitutional amendment, or is that just a policy change?
Well, I think the Congress is not likely to give up its right to review these programs on an annual basis, and some programs do get out of control. And Congress, when something goes wrong, when a program runs over budget or something, then everyone yells at Congress and says, well, Congress, why weren't you providing better oversight of this? So Congress basically is where the buck stops in terms of funding, and so I think they want to reserve their right to review programs on an annual basis to make certain that they don't get too far off track.
So there's really no way to assure funding for a project for 10 years in order to complete the project?
Not under our current system.
Do you see any way that would ever change? I mean, could it change?
Well, anything is possible. You know, one can. I don't know that it would require a constitutional amendment to do that, but it would require Congress to change the way it works, and that seems very unlikely.
So if we go to current events, do you expect anything significantly different with the new Congress once they come into power for NASA? And since you also cover military space for DoD space as well?
Well, again, I don't want people to think that the only thing that matters for space is budget, but budget is a big factor in all of this. And I think the key is going to be whether or not, when the Republicans control both houses, if they are going to dig in on this issue of reducing the deficit and balancing the budget and either keep the sequester or replace it with something that has the same effect on agencies like NASA. Nobody likes a sequester, but they couldn't come up with anything better. And this is when you had Democrats in control of one chamber and Republicans in charge of the other. It's been the Republicans that have really been focusing on deficit reduction and reducing the size of government. So it's possible, but they like defense. And so they could exempt the defense budget from these kinds of cuts. But unless they are able to go after the mandatory spending, which consumes a big part of the federal budget, then these other agencies, like NASA and NOAA and everybody else, they're going to feel the brunt of these budget cuts. And the Republicans talk a lot about going after mandatory spending, Social Security, Medicare, those kinds of programs, but they are very popular across the country. Many people benefit from these programs, and so there's only so far that even the Republicans could go in cutting those programs to make more money available for discretionary spending or to simply reduce the deficit. So there are limits as to how far they can go and still be able to win the next election, whereas, of course, in Washington, the minute one election is over, then you start campaigning for the next one.
Do you hear that the Republicans are going to dig in on this? Do you have any information like that?
No. Right now, everybody's focused on just getting the 113th Congress done and what they're going to do with appropriations. And, of course, the Republicans are all very upset about President Obama's decision to move forward on immigration, and that's sort of the focus of everything today.
Do you believe that, or do you see any evidence that NASA holds any special place in Congress's heart and in the minds of all the people in government, so that it can get any kind of special treatment? And you know, the space enthusiasts and the space advocates all think, you know, if they just understood NASA better, if they understood space better, you know, we could do a lot more important things and get more money. Is there any indication that NASA and space could rise up in priority and be better understood? I'm just using language from some of the callers I get and people that I talk to on the show. Is there any evidence to support any of that?
So the number of members of Congress, House and Senate, that focus on NASA is very small. You pick any issue except maybe defense, and you're going to find just a very small number of members of Congress who focus on it. The ones who do focus on it really like NASA. They really do. And if you look at, I'm going to call it the proposed funding level for NASA for fiscal 15, NASA did very well. Now, this is partially because they'd reached this temporary truce for fiscal 14 and 15 on the sequester, so there was more money available to be spent. But the appropriations committees decided to spend some of that on NASA. Both the House, which passed their bill, would add, I think it was about $400 million for NASA above the president's request, and the Senate Appropriations Committee recommended the same level. It wasn't dispersed exactly the same way. So I think that NASA, generally speaking, is very popular. And the question is where it fits in overall national priorities. And if you're going to reduce the deficit by across-the-board spending cuts, I think it's unlikely that NASA is going to be exempted from that. The only agency I can think of that would be exempted, and maybe not even fully exempted, would be defense.
You have a question from Marilyn, who's in St. Louis, by email, and says, David, it's Friday and I'm at work, but please ask the question, if NASA did get an additional $400 million, does Congress tell NASA how to spend the money and on what projects, or is that totally under the control and choice of the NASA administrator?
No, when Congress passes a bill, and for example, that extra plus-up that the House and Senate committee both gave them, they were very specific about how the money was going to be spent. For example, adding money for SOFIA. So this is how Congress retains the power of the purse. Now, under a continuing resolution, they give up some of that power because it's just sort of blanket, and we'll keep spending it the way you were spending it before. And then the executive branch has more control over, you know, all the little pennies and where they all go. So Congress actually keeps more power to itself if it passes the actual appropriations bills rather than a CR.
So Congress can mandate you're going to fund SLS no matter what.
Congress did.
I know they did, but I mean, they can keep mandating that.
Yes.
With the money, and NASA has no choice but to do that.
That's right. NASA has to spend the money the way Congress appropriates it.
So is there, what percentage of the NASA, let's say it's an $18 billion a year budget, is there any percentage of it that is discretionary for the NASA administrator?
Oh, there may be some money. It would be very small. I mean, I couldn't really answer that question definitively. I'm sure that the administrator has a little pot of money that he gets to spend on particular grants or something. I wouldn't say a grant, but initiatives that he may be interested in, but I think it's probably a small amount of money.
So is this what is meant when people say NASA, Congress needs to quit micromanaging NASA?
Well, I think, you know, different people mean different things by that phrase, but there are some people who think that Congress should just keep hands off of NASA, that they, the person, whoever's speaking, knows better than Congress how to spend the money, and that Congress should just stay out of it and just write a blank check. And not surprisingly, Congress doesn't agree with that. Congress is responsible for these programs. They have the power of the purse. They're the ones giving agencies, including NASA, the money to spend. And they do feel that they get a lot of expert input from all of these hearings that they hold, and everybody coming to them and saying, no, 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 fund my program, not his program. And, you know, there are lobbyists and interest groups, and everybody goes to Congress saying, no, 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 fund my program instead. So they get an awful lot of input. They're very smart people, and a lot of them have spent a lot of time on these NASA committees. And the chairman of the Appropriations Subcommittee that is going to be funding NASA, it has been Frank Wolf from Virginia, but he's retiring, and they just announced yesterday that John Culbertson from Texas is going to become chair of that subcommittee, and he's from a district that's in Houston, very close to Johnson Space Center, and he is one of the biggest supporters of robotic spacecraft in Congress, and in particular the Europa mission.
Yeah, I've been
and
reading about
it. Very
that,
knowledgeable. Yeah. So he's very knowledgeable, and on the Senate side, presumably it's going to be Shelby and Mikulski again, and they're very knowledgeable, and their staff is very knowledgeable. So you have some really smart people making these decisions.
So we might see a congressional focus on funding a Europa mission here.
Well, there is already, of course, and that's thanks to Mr. Culbertson. Even though he wasn't chair of the subcommittee, he's a member of it, and Adam Schiff from the Democrat.
From California.
From California, JPL. They've been the leaders of it, and they've been very successful in convincing their colleagues that this is a very important mission to fund.
Jack is in Tucson, Arizona, and he says, also at work, David. Marcia, does private or entrepreneurial space figure in the budget process somehow?
Only to the extent that it's a public-private partnership, like commercial cargo or commercial crew. So, you know, programs like Virgin Galactic, for example, you know, with that terrible accident that they had, but that is strictly private sector money, and so the budget debate doesn't affect what they're doing. And Blue Origin is working on this engine, and they've now got this deal with the United Launch Alliance, and they're saying that they've got that money covered, and they don't need government money for that. But, of course, they need the government as a customer of the launches. So it's impacted that way. But the things that people think of as commercial right now, they think of commercial cargo and commercial crew, and those are really public-private partnerships with a lot of government money going into them, and they are affected by the budget debates. But something like Planetary Resources doing mining on asteroids, that should not be affected.
So people need to understand that anything that happens in the regulatory regime that may affect private and entrepreneurial space doesn't have anything to do with the budget discussions that we're talking about right now.
Only in the sense that those offices need to be funded. So the FAA's Office of Commercial Space Transportation needs to have money to operate, but the regulations are not budget dependent. That doesn't mean that Congress doesn't have a role in them, because Congress, of course, passes laws that govern regulations. The regulatory regime comes out of the laws.
And FAA AST is Department of Transportation, and that's
correct.
And that's discretionary, correct?
It is.
So,
and they're funded, I think, $15 million or something a year.
And
but I think they're under a little bit of stress right now, because they're working on both of these accident investigations, Antares and Spaceship Two.
Now does Congress tell AST and FAA what to spend their money on, too? I mean, they control that as well?
They control, so the FAA also collects fees. And so agencies that can collect fees spend the money. You know, I'm not certain, I'll be honest, I don't know who regulates how they spend their money that comes from fees, but it's not through an appropriations process. So the FAA AST office is funded through appropriated funds, but there are other things the FAA may do on a fee base.
Jerry is in Seattle and says, is the FAA authorized to investigate aircraft accidents outside the United States, for example, when the plane was shot down over the Ukraine? Does the FAA take part in that in type of an investigation, and are the taxpayers funding that?
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know anything about aviation.
I think they're brought in and requested for help, and yeah, it would come out of whatever the agency's funding is, because they do play a role, but they're not the lead agency. I think the Dutch were the lead in that, since it was it took off in Holland, as I remember. But when the plane crashed in San Francisco, that was clearly an FAA investigation all the way.
I thought that was NTSB.
NTSB, yeah. Well, I'm getting them confused, yeah.
Right.
But they'll act as a consultant with another crash outside the United States, but I don't think they've ever become the lead agency outside the U.S. And we pay for that, and I think we should. Do you see, so for looking forward for 2015, it's really an unknown because nobody knows how hard the Republicans will dig in on their lines that they want to cut the deficit and reduce government spending, and that's where things seem to hinge on, correct?
Right. So the first step is they need to get the fiscal 15 appropriations done. It's not done yet. Right now, the whole part of the discretionary part of the government is operating on a continuing resolution that expires on December 11th. The Republican and Democratic leaders in Congress insist that there's not going to be another government shutdown, but there are others, like the Tea Party Republicans, who think that the government shutdown is a good tactic, especially, you know, when they're going up against an administration where they have strong disagreements. So I don't think anything is really off the table. They may get something from December 11th into, say, mid-January, just, you know, do another CR because that's the best that they can do. But the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, who is a Republican, Hal Rogers from Kentucky, is just determined to get all 12 of the appropriations bills done, covering all the way to the end of the fiscal year. And we're just going to have to wait over the next couple of weeks and see who wins that battle. And then you get to worry about fiscal 16, and so the budget request for that will come up probably in February, come up to Congress from the president in February.
Now, for people coming into Congress, how do they end up on this or that committee? Do they get to choose? Are they assigned?
They are assigned to the committees. They put in their requests, and then their caucuses, you know, the leadership of their party caucuses decide who goes on which committee.
So they could get something that they don't even want or have an interest in theory?
They could. But, I mean, they try to match people's interests, you know, because by and large politicians are particularly interested in whatever is going on in their district or their state.
Uh-huh.
And they got elected in order to represent their voters, and so there is an effort made to do that. But there may be, you know, sometimes when you can only have so many members on a committee, and they're still deciding how many members each party gets on a committee depends on the ratio in the overall chamber of Democrats to Republicans. And so in the House, the Republicans gained, I think, 12 seats. And so the Democrats lost that. And so the ratios now on the committees will be different as to how many Democrats can be on a committee versus how many Republicans. So, you know, they have to even that all out as to how many people can be on each committee and which members are going to be there.
Can you be in the House and Senate and not be on any committee?
I am not aware of any member who is not on a committee.
So they're on at least one?
I think so.
Is there a maximum number of committees they can be on?
There is, depending on what you're assigned to, so like people who are on the Appropriations Committee are not on any other committees. I think people on Intelligence Committees are not on any other committees because those committees will consume all of their time. But if you're on the Science Committee, you can be on another committee. And in the Senate, there are, you know, you serve on multiple committees because there are only 100 senators as opposed to 435 members of the House.
And Todd is in San Diego, California, and he said, really nice weather down here today, guys. Just thought I'd mention that. My question is, what would it take to get NASA treated as a special priority and really have their budget increased along the lines of what Neil deGrasse Tyson and others have called for, maybe by $5 or $6 billion, and they'd have to reprioritize NASA over other agencies? What would it take to make that happen?
I have no idea, to tell you the honest truth. I mean, I cannot imagine a circumstance under which that would happen. It's just unrealistic. And the National Research Council recently did a study on the future of the human spaceflight program, and one of the specific tasks they were asked to look at is public opinion about the space program. And so they looked at polls that have been done historically, and I think they may have done a poll of their own. And the bottom line was that the American people just don't pay any attention. It's not that they don't care about space. It's just not on their radar screen. And it's been true historically, and it's true today. And their bottom line was that this gives a lot of flexibility to Washington policymakers to decide the fate of the space program, because the public is not going to oppose something that Washington does, and they're not going to rise up in great masses and tell Washington to do something differently. And it is important for people to remember that it's not just Congress, it is also the executive branch that determines what NASA does. And, there certainly are very passionate people in the space community who want to see money added to NASA, but it is not pervasive, and I don't know of any way to make it pervasive. And people look back at Apollo and say, oh, well, we did it during Apollo, but actually Roger Lanius at the Air and Space Museum has done some very interesting research about how the public felt about Apollo, and there was only 1 year when more than 50% of the public supported the Apollo program, and I believe that was the year that we landed.
The first time.
And all the rest of the time, the public was not that supportive of Apollo. It was the Washington politicians who made Apollo happen.
You're going to love this question, Marcia. Are you ready for this one?
So, oh, dear.
Well, I mean, it's not hard, but it goes a long way into the way space people, space advocates think. So this is Ralph in Phoenix, Arizona. And he says, I'm also at work, but this question is really good for email anyway. On recent space show programs, guests have been asked by listeners that if SpaceX is highly successful with their Falcon Heavy rocket, would such an incredible successful launch of this heavy lift rocket by a private company be so impressive and so compelling on the minds of the American people that it would force Congress to reconsider funding the SLS? Half the people asked this question say yes, such a successful Falcon Heavy demonstration would absolutely change the mood of the country and compel SLS to change. Others think it would have no impact whatsoever. What do you think?
So the question is, if Falcon Heavy is successful, that SLS will change, or that it
would be
discontinued?
It would be discontinued because I remember the conversations. They think it would be so successful and so impressive that a private company could do this so much cheaper than what the government is spending on SLS, that they would realize SLS is just totally futile, and they'll go with the private company, and the American people will be so impressed by SpaceX that they will rise up and demand that Congress quit funding SLS.
I guess I consider it unlikely that the American people will rise up and demand anything based on what I just said, because I don't think the American people, broadly speaking, are following space enough to know that, and they probably don't even know that we're building a space launch system. If they've heard about SpaceX, it's because of Dragon, because Dragon carries people, and that always seems to pique people's interest. And, you know, they're looking at Dragon as something that's going to be taking people back and forth, because that's a lot of where the publicity has been. And I'm not sure that Falcon Heavy is just another rocket is going to spark that much public interest. It'll be fascinating in the space community, but I'm not sure it's going to spark widespread public interest. But even if it did, Falcon Heavy is not in the same class as SLS. The smallest version of SLS is 70 tons, right?
Yeah,
and it's going to grow to 130 tons. Falcon Heavy is 56 or something.
53 tons.
53. So they're not in the same class, and they're not designed for the same purpose. You know, Falcon Heavy, as far as I know, it's designed mostly for commercial launches of very large spacecraft, and I know that SpaceX has plans to use it to send people off to Mars and all of that, but they may find that they need something bigger than 53 tons also.
Yeah, well, they have a big rocket that they're planning, which is bigger than even SLS on the drawing board. But
I'm not familiar with that one, but, I mean, let's face it. One of the reasons we have a space launch system is because Congress wanted NASA to build a big rocket. And even if Senator Shelby retires, someone else will be elected from Alabama, and I suspect that that senator is also going to be very interested in ensuring that Marshall Space Flight Center continues to have a strong role and that NASA, as the flagship American space agency, continues to have a role in doing this.
But he wouldn't have the seniority that Shelby has, so would he still have the impact and influence to do that?
Well, we'll see. And I haven't heard that Senator Shelby is planning to retire.
No, I haven't.
And I wouldn't
heard that
want
either.
It to see. I mean, people talk about Shelby, and he obviously is very passionate about it, but he's obviously getting a lot of his fellow senators to go along with it, so it's not just him. And so SLS and Orion exist because of Congress representing the American people.
Let me take this question a step further. Are you familiar with any kind of media event or media pressure that has had a really substantial impact on space policy?
Gosh, I'm not quite sure I'm following that. A media event?
Yeah, so has something
been a
that
movie
the,
or something? Is that
well,
the question?
Or I'm thinking more of the press. Has the press ever gotten so strongly behind something in space that it's compelled Congress to do this or that? Have they ever taken on a topic or a venture or a subject and written so strongly about it and sort of, you know, drummed up interest to the point where Congress takes note of it and then acts in support of what the press has been writing about? Is that ever?
I'm not familiar with it, and most of the journalists I know write about things that other people are interested in, not what they're interested in, and so you can have a particular scientist who's very interested in something who knows a reporter, and they write a story about some particular scientific activity that the scientist wants, and, you know, and that can bring something to the attention of Congress, which would then lead to more discussions and maybe a hearing or something like that, so it can sort of get the ball rolling if something shows up in the press. But I don't think, you know, just having all the journalists in America rise up and write articles about how we should do something different, I don't think that's going to change anything.
You have a telephone call. Let me pick it up. Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Doug from Southern California.
Hi, Doug. Welcome back. How are you?
Yeah, I think the concept of the successful launch of the Falcon Heavy, I don't think was well represented. The issue is not whether the public would rise up and demand that the Falcon Heavy be used instead of the SLS. I don't think that was ever the argument. The argument is really that if there is a successful launch of a Falcon Heavy, perhaps in 2015, then the question is, given the capability of the Falcon Heavy, might that draw into question the need for the SLS, not amongst the public, but amongst the intelligent policymakers who have staff who understand these things? It is true, as your guest says, that the Falcon Heavy is in a different class than the SLS. But I think the relevant point here is the question of, could two docked Falcon Heavy payloads in low Earth orbit, which would come to 106 metric tons, that is considerably higher than the SLS Block 1. So might policymakers take a look at the rather significantly less cost of kilograms or tons to LEO that the Falcon Heavy could provide as compared to the SLS? Might that comparison create questions as to what direction we ought to use in terms of launcher? And if there is any question about whether two payloads can dock safely in low Earth orbit with a high reliability, I'd just like to point out that we've had over 300 dockings or berthings in low Earth orbit, many of them at the International Space Station. And the vast majority, like I think maybe about 99.7% of them, in fact, docked successfully. So that's the context. So let me just re-ask the question of your guest. Given those circumstances, might a successful launch of the Falcon Heavy impact the thinking amongst policymakers about what approach is now available?
Well, I'm not quite sure how to respond to that. There was an earlier question about Congress micromanaging NASA and the like, and so if the question is what should be the future of the human spaceflight program, and if we're going to send people back to the moon and onto Mars, should we be doing it on the Falcon Heavy or the SLS, then people who don't want Congress micromanaging NASA should say, well, that should be really NASA's decision. So I don't know that Congress should be dictating that a Falcon Heavy should be used instead of a space launch system. And again, they're in different classes, and this issue about whether or not you can use multiple launches of smaller rockets and dock spacecraft together has been debated for many years, because people talk about using the Atlas V and Delta IV, and you know, Falcon Heavy would be no different in that regard. There are technical experts who feel strongly on one side or another as to whether or not that's a wise architectural approach or not. And, you know, those debates have been held. I'm sure they're going to continue to be held. And whether or not there is one more rocket in the stable, a Falcon 9 Heavy, as compared to other rockets like the Delta IV and the Atlas V, I'm not sure that's going to make much of a difference. If the Falcon Heavy actually works and it's a tenth of the cost of a Delta IV, and so you could have, and you can build so many of them that if you have a launch failure and you can afford to build a replacement payload, so you can have, you know, some launch failures and still get all of the hardware that you need in Earth orbit that you need to dock together in order to go to whatever destination you're going to, you know, then maybe that would make a difference. But, you know, I'm not convinced that Falcon Heavy is going to be that cheap compared to a Delta IV. If it is, you know, well, then we'll see whether or not that changes the debate. But that's not going to happen for some time yet. And I think we're just going to have to wait and see.
Well, let me clarify some technical issues, because I think they're relevant here. The Falcon Heavy is not in the same class as the Delta IV. It's in the intermediate or sort of low heavy. Falcon Heavy is, I think, in a low heavy class. And Delta IV is sort of in the upper end of the smaller rockets, and so 50. I mean, Delta IV Heavy is 32 tons to LEO. Is that right? Do either of you know?
Well,
I thought it was 25, but
it's about 25 or 26.
Oh, okay, so 25. And Falcon Heavy using cross-feed, we will see, but it's being reported to be at 53, and so it's basically double. And so it makes quite a difference from a technical standpoint and from a risk standpoint, because, and to some extent a financial standpoint, because if it's a difference of needing four Delta IV Heavies to launch a mission, for example, a Golden Spike mission to the surface of the moon, it would take really only two Falcon Heavy launches to accomplish the same thing. And yeah, it would be, for Falcon Heavy, be just a single docking as opposed to three dockings on the part of the Delta IV Heavy. So from a risk standpoint, I think it's quite a bit different between those two rockets.
But your question, Doug, is would this kind of success and addition of a rocket impact policymakers to rethink whether SLS is a good investment for the American taxpayer?
Or whether there is a more cost-effective alternative now for the low-end SLS, or for those missions that the 70 metric ton SLS would be used for. And that would be basically in cislunar space, in the your EML 2 type mission, including your ARM mission.
Okay, and not to put words in Marcia's mouth, but I don't think she's believes it would have that kind of impact on policy.
Well, I think Golden Spike is a private initiative. As far as I know, it doesn't involve any government money. Falcon Heavy is a private initiative. As far as I know, it doesn't involve any government money. So, you know, if SpaceX can develop a Falcon Heavy to launch Golden Spike missions around the moon, then more power to them. But that's not really a government funding issue. That might be a regulatory issue, but not a government funding issue.
I'm only using Golden Spike as an example of what's possible. So Golden Spike is not particularly relevant. What's relevant is the mission that NASA is imagining, such as, for example, an EML-2 mission in which astronauts in an Orion capsule are telerobotically controlling rovers on the backside of the moon, doing, you know, the South Pole Aiken mission, for example, or perhaps laying out a large antenna on the back side of the moon for radio, a radio telescope sort of mission in the silent spot. These sorts of ideas have been discussed as possible NASA missions. And from my calculations, it seems as though Falcon Heavy could achieve those missions at reasonable risk and much, much lower cost than the SLS Block 1. Which would normally be used for those missions, I believe. And so my question still stands, given the capability that a cross-fed Falcon Heavy could provide, now that there is a brand new tool in the stable that policymakers could draw upon in order to support a not a private venture, but a government NASA venture, if that tool becomes available in the next year or two, might that affect how people think about whether that tool should be used or not?
I think that there are different things that could happen that could cause a reconsideration of whether or not to build the SLS. I guess I'm just not convinced that the success of Falcon Heavy or not would be the key factor that causes a reconsideration of SLS.
Doug, what I would do if I were you, and for those who believe this, is write it up very succinctly and very short and send it to the lead staffers in the House and Senate committees that deal with this and ask them for their opinion if they would consider this and how it might impact their thinking in terms of continued funding for SLS if this were a reality, and see what they tell you. I suspect they will answer you and see what they tell you.
I do actually have a connection with a space policy advisor for one of the representatives down in Texas, and he seemed open-minded to these things, so maybe I could start there.
Well, start there, but I'd go to the main staffers on the committees and see what they tell you, if they would even be open-minded enough to look at that kind of evidence.
Well, I sort of suspect Shelby, for example, wouldn't be open-minded because it...
Don't make assumptions.
Well, you know, Marshall is in his district, so
yeah,
I think it's reasonable to make that assumption.
Don't make assumptions. I'm going to just put that out there. Assumption making is really critical, and you never know what people will do with new information. It doesn't hurt you to send a letter to the, and you can find out who the staffers are that deal with space and technology in the House and Senate, and see what they tell you.
That's true. All right. Well, thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Bye bye.
How do we find out who the staffers are that deal with science, with space and technology issues? Are they listed on the subcommittee websites? How do we find out who these people are?
Actually, it's not as common these days for committees to list who the staff are, but and there are commercial publications that will tell you all of them. I think Congressional Quarterly has a yellow book that lists all the congressional staff.
You have an email from Bijan, who is in Sweden. And boy, as soon as I mention SLS, the topic goes ballistic. When the Space Launch System is available in maybe 5 to 10 years, do you think it will create new political options for a more generous space policy? This is just the opposite of what we've been talking about. Is it realistic to hope that Washington opportunistically would take advantage of using the capability of a heavy lift launch vehicle to go for some big space missions?
Well, I think that's one of the challenges for the SLS program right now, is trying to explain what it would be used for. So the Senate Appropriations Committee put language in their report. Again, this hasn't become law, and reports aren't law anyway, but they sort of guide law. But that the Europa mission that some people want should be designed to be launched on the SLS. So I don't know what the cost of an SLS launch is going to be. And it could be that, you know, they charge a marginal cost instead of full cost or an average cost. You know, you can do different things with numbers. But if you're going to take advantage of the SLS and pay some amount of money for that launch, and then you're going to build a big spacecraft to take advantage of its lift capability, it's going to be a very expensive spacecraft. And if the government's doing this, then that's still taxpayer money, and you're going to have to ask yourself, is that how you want to spend taxpayer money, or do you want to spend it on other things? That's what, you know, again, I keep getting back to budgets, but I think that that is the reality. So right now, when they're looking at SLS, they're thinking of launching only once every 2 years, because they don't have payloads to go on it. And if you're going to build the payloads, someone's going to have to pay for it. Either the government's paying for it or the private sector's paying for it.
I want them to spend the money on it, but they don't listen to me. Does technical in engineering, things like the last two questions and Doug's caller have dealt with, are they big factors in policy making, or does policy making and budget making come about without so much of a focus on technical and engineering? Do they look at TRLs and things like that, or are there a lot of other more important issues in policy making?
Yeah, and that's a very broad question, and so everybody, I'm sure, could find examples of where, say, policymakers have gotten very involved in TRL levels, but by and large, at the congressional level, they would not get involved in something like TRLs. They would want to know whether or not a cost estimate for a mission is realistic, and whether or not a cost estimate is realistic can depend on TRL levels. But it's unusual for Congress to get into that level of detail. Not that it's never happened, but it's unusual.
We're at the hour point in the show. Should I have asked you something different that you think is important to mention to our listeners, or have I forgotten something?
No, the only message I try to get across to people in terms of how Washington works is to remember that it is not NASA deciding what it does. NASA is told what to do by the White House and Congress, and therefore it ends up sort of in the crosshairs, not the crosshairs, it ends up in the middle between the White House and Congress on some of these issues. It happens more, it seems, in human spaceflight than in science, but it can happen in science as well, and in space technology and aeronautics and the other things that NASA gets involved in. But a lot of people say, well, why doesn't NASA do this or why doesn't NASA do that? And that's because NASA is part of the executive branch. It follows the president's lead, and it also obeys the laws that are passed by Congress. So it's all very complicated.
You got one more 11th hour email. Can I read it to you?
Sure.
This is from Kelly. Kelly's a guy. I don't know where Kelly is right now. Could the political changes drive, I guess he's talking about the congressional changes, could the political changes drive a change to more SAR versus FAR contracting for big projects, given the SAR was shown to cut cost on NASA projects by a factor of 4, or does Congress still prefer the FAR for pork oversight and other reasons?
So you're saying SAA, the Space Act Agreement?
Yes.
Act Agreements versus the Federal Acquisition Regulations?
Right, so cost plus versus fixed price, basically.
Well, I think that that's really on a case-by-case basis. NASA signs an awful lot of Space Act Agreements. Sometimes they're funded, sometimes they're unfunded, and by and large, they go unnoticed. But when you get into the big programs, like commercial crew, then you can get congressional interest into which of those procurement methods are being used. And I do think that when you get into some of these programs, there is a point, as happened with commercial crew, that you need to move into the FAR-based regime to provide the government with the kind of oversight that it really needs.
Anything that we should look for to give us hints on what might happen as the new Congress takes hold in early January? Are you looking at any points to come about to give you hints of what's going to happen?
Well, I think one key will be whether or not they decide that deficit reduction is still the key issue for them, and if they are going to accomplish that through these across-the-board cuts known as a sequester, because I think that would be probably bad news for NASA. But if there's some flexibility on that and they feel the economy may have improved a little bit now that the election's over, maybe they can say maybe the economy's not so bad, maybe they can find a way to ease up on the funding issues.
And then the president gives a new budget for fiscal year 16 in early to mid-February, right?
It's supposed to be presented to Congress the first Monday of February.
And
the Obama administration hasn't met that deadline because Congress has not passed the appropriations bill for the previous year in a timely manner. So there is a tie-in between knowing what you're going to get for the current year and what you're going to ask for the next year.
Do you expect gridlock?
I do. I'm sorry, but I think realistically things are not going to improve very much, even though one party is controlling all of Congress now instead of it being split. I think there's still enough disagreements that it's going to be a very, very tough Congress.
But even when the Democrats had all of the government in the first 2 years, NASA didn't flourish as a result of that. So they didn't reprioritize NASA, you know, the way a lot of space enthusiasts would like to see happen.
Yes, I'm afraid that's a little bit of wishful thinking.
Okay, well, we'll talk after the budget comes out and we'll for fiscal year 16, and we'll see what they're proposing and what space looks like at that time, okay?
Okay.
I want to thank you for being with us again and for teaching us Civics 101. I'll tell you, if it gets really bad over there teaching high school, you might do really well.
That would be fun, too.
be a substitute if you could keep the class in order. Well, I'm sure you could, but I'd even fly in for your class. So.
Oh, well, thank you, David.
Thank you very much for being with us. Have a happy Thanksgiving and holiday season, Marcia.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Listeners, that's it for today. And we have an NSBRI program on the human factors with ocular studies with the two main researchers on Sunday. So you can read about it in the newsletter. And they're going to talk about their additional human factors research, medical issues, and how starting up entrepreneurial medical research actions and companies and ideas for spaceflight is starting to take hold. So I think you'll find that program very interesting on Sunday. Goodbye, everybody, from the Space Show.